Dear brothers and sisters, Namo Buddhaya. Not quite like an Indian audience, I'm afraid. A long way to go. I know I'm not saying Jai Bhim. Anyway, for those of you who are keenly awaiting a health bulletin, I'm improving. But I'm still not well, so sympathy is still required. I spent these days, not just because I'm not feeling well, but just because of what I feel like doing, just in my room, just reflecting, reading a little bit, meditating, and just doing nothing, basically. And all the time, talks have been cooking themselves. I haven't exactly decided what I'm going to talk about, more or less until I step onto the platform. But the talks have been sort of cooking themselves, and usually they cook around particular images. And the image that seems to have crystallised today is my first meeting with Bhante. Well, not my first meeting with Bhante, my first sighting of Bhante. I've spoken about this a number of times, so some of you may have already heard me mention it. But I used to live in North London, in Kentish Town, and I used to walk from time to time up to Parliament Hill Fields on Hampstead Heath, one of those glories of London, these marvellous pieces of open space. And one day I was coming back off the heath and walking back towards my flat, and I saw a figure coming towards me. It immediately arrested me, the figure, because it had a long brown cloak. By now I was aware it was a man. It had a long brown cloak and long hair, but at the same time, you know, a middle-aged man, not a young hippie. So it's long brown cloak, and underneath the cloak you could see flashes of orange. And so it's immediately an arresting sight, even though in London in the late 60s, there were many arresting sites, some of which you could be arrested for. I was immediately struck by, you know, what I saw, just because it was unusual. But then my attention was caught. There was something about this figure. He moved with enormous presence. It's the only way I can put it. The tremendous sense of self-possession, as if he really knew he was walking, and his entire concentration, his entire focus was in walking. Not that he was preoccupied and thinking about something else, you know, like sometimes people are. They're walking along, but their minds are whirring. You didn't get that impression. He was completely absorbed in walking. It made a very strong impact on me. The image sort of burned into my mind. My second sighting of Bhante was at the Rolling Stones concert in Hyde Park, where they did a long version of Sympathy for the Devil. I think Dumadina must have been there. Of course she was. And I saw this orange-clad figure picking his way through the discarded bodies. I've accused Bhante of being there, and he completely denies it. But I have an absolutely total recall of that situation, which, of course, is absolutely totally unreliable in the circumstances. this impression of Bhante's enormous self-possession and a sense that he knew where he was going, not in the sense he knew what his destination was, but that he knew where he was going in life. And when I eventually met Bhante face-to-face in a class at the Monmouth Street Centre, down in that strange little basement, crammed with people, all sort of frozen into a sort of strange... social inhibition. I don't know why. Maybe because of the associations of meditation and so forth. We all got very, very, you remember, all got very sort of uptight. Anyway, Bhante was sitting there completely unconcerned. I won't say more about what he looked like at that time. But then in the meditation, again, I got this extraordinary impression of a man who knew exactly what he was doing, why he was there, and who was completely at ease. He was very, very relaxed. That really struck me. The questions and answers later, I think it was that night, it might have been another one. And again, just a really strong sense of his confidence about what he was doing, where he was going. He could answer any question and answer it very, very intelligently, wittily, and appositely, so that one felt one was addressed. But I suppose that impression of Bhante has persisted. You know, I've had my own ups and downs with Bhante, inevitably. My personality and its foibles have certainly led to ups and downs. I've even had periods of feeling quite alienated from Bhante, fortunately, some time ago. But this sense of Bhante as somebody who was following an inner direction, which he was completely confident in, was a very strong experience of him. The sense that he really knew what he was doing, where he was going. At the same time, he certainly carefully explained to me, he doesn't have a sort of plan of life. He doesn't think out what he's going to do months and months in advance. Yes, he used to have a schedule and be committed to doing something at such and such a time and so on. But he said that even in the founding of the order and movement, it was never a plan. He just found himself in a situation where he'd been shut out of the existing Buddhist establishment or movement, and it needed a new start, which was something of a relief to him. But he didn't have a big plan of where it was going to go, what it was going to be like. He simply sort of let it unfold. And I've always had that sense of him, that even though he's a very meticulous man, very careful about detail, and very sharp eye for problems and issues, and particularly for wrong views, you never get a sense that he's single-minded in that sense some people are, obsessive single-mindedness. There seems to be an openness to experiences as it unfolds, based upon, well, an inner unfolding. So this for me has been a very, very strong sense of Bhante. And I associate it with this, what did I call it, transcendental subject that I talked of yesterday. It's a dodgy term. What it really means is that the sense that, as it were, coming from within the subjective dimension of your experience, there is something that goes beyond that polarity. That you get a very strong sense that Bhante is flowing with something, which he's quite confident of, completely confident of. So for me, that's always been one of the major attractions of Bhante, that he's flowing with something. I remember him once, very early on, I think one of the first chairs meetings that we had, saying something like, well, whether the Buddha taught this or not, this is what I think. Of course, the Buddha did teach it too, but his sense of confidence in his own unfolding experience is very, very important to me. And I've also experienced Bhante, it's very strongly affirming that unfolding in me. Not by saying, yes, yes, I can see that unfolding in you, carry on, old chap. Never anything like that, never very explicit. In a way, never very personal, in relation to me at least. But the whole context he's established, all the rhetoric of those early days, the early movement, the seminars and so forth, I felt strongly affirming something vital to me, an unfolding inner I say drive, that is such, that's too cold a word, but an unfolding movement within me that was deeply important to me. So I want to talk a little bit more about this dimension of the polarity I talked of yesterday, because I think it could do with more explication, and I want to try to tie it up with themes like suprapersonal forces and so on. See if I can, if I can get there. It does, that both poles appeal to me strongly. I do experience very strongly at times a sense of a transcendental object, something outside me, so to speak, that is beyond my narrow, clinging world. I also experience something inside me, but beyond me, beyond my narrow, clinging world. And the sort of tension between the two is my Dhamma life. And going for refuge at its best is where those two are in perfect harmony. I think that it's important because it stresses the natural quality of Dhamma life, which again is something really important to me. I suffered from a mild Christian upbringing. The Church of England can never be anything but mild. The via media par excellence. Nonetheless, I had sort of ideas about what I ought to be, what I ought to do, and so forth, as most people do get. And so I found it extremely appealing that there was something natural to me, not really to me, but naturally occurring within me that was in tune with something deep in the universe, to put it that way. Bhante often used to sort of encourage us to rely on that and to open up to it. And one would often get the impression that he sort of opened up to one the possibility of simply flowing with that, almost without effort. Of course, it's not that simple. But he showed the way in which that unfolding spirit within one, to call it spirit, so difficult to find a word that doesn't immediately imply something else, but that unfolding movement within one that one simply needs to cooperate with, to allow to unfold, and that is completely in tune with that transcendental object, as it were, conceived outside. So, yes, I find this very, very appealing, and I'd like to try and bring a little bit more out of it. One feels, when one's in touch with that, one feels that's all you need. One could just stay with that. If I can just stay with that movement, that drive, that urge within one, you wouldn't need to practice, you wouldn't need to discipline yourself, it would just unfold. But we all know it's not actually like that. Those moments come and they go. They come, they go. They go rather more than they come. Perhaps as we go on, they come a little bit more than they go before. But it's not something that's easy to stay with. For why? Well, very obviously, we've already really spoken of this yesterday at some length. Because our experience is instinctively structured in terms of a defensive self, which is independent of experience, having experience, and which is the agent for our survival. That's deeply imbued in our experience. It's not actually, it's not prior to experience, it's an interpretation of experience. It's quite important. The problem is epistemological, not ontological. It's not buried in the nature of our existence. It's buried in our way of understanding and interpreting it. So that that instinctive sense that I exist independently of this perceiving moment, of this experiential situation, and that that I is the real me, and that that I is really the measure of everything in my experience. Of course, it's not always a kind of an unpleasant or unskillful impulse that arises from it. You can have feelings of love, you can have feelings of generosity, but they're still ultimately rooted in this sense of a separate self, an abiding separate self. This is basic Dhamma. And so that comes into conflict with this unfolding sense of something that is more than us, that works through us. And it overrides it, so that for a little while we experience something unfolding within us, we feel ourselves being drawn to something, as it were, beyond us, but something intervenes. The old patterns of egoistic self-clinging reassert themselves. Well, reassert? They've hardly even been suspended. Just a temporary blink of the eye, as it were. And in a way, you've got the whole issue of Dhamma life in that framing. You've got these processes that seek to unfold themselves through you, so to speak, which you feel as not everybody seems to identify them, but certainly it must be that we've all felt those. Otherwise, I don't know how we got here. Our ordination processes need a considerable revision. We can't just go with them, because something gets in the way, not just gets in the way, but even appropriates those very forces, appropriates the transcendental subject and turns it into mine, appropriates the transcendental object and turns it into my ideal or whatever, my idea. And perverts, subverts it. A lot of religion, I think, is the perversion of genuine experience. If you look at the Brahmajala Sutta, you can see the way in which so many of the wrong views are taking genuine experience and interpreting it in a distorted way. So yes, we're blocked by our habitual self-clinging, which of course is has its roots below the level of our conscious awareness. That has its roots in the instinctual structure of our minds. It even has its roots in perhaps the physiology of it, the neurology of it. It's probably as deep as that. The perceptual situation presents itself to us in this bifurcated way, and if we're to survive within that situation, we require some simplification of it in terms of identification of elements in it that are harmful, pleasurable, etc., and in terms of what is important to survive. So it's very deeply buried in us, and the whole of our issue, the whole of the Dhamma life in the first place, is getting that out of the way, so that something that is more than us can draw us on and work through us. This is the way Bhante has spoken. Not in these exact terms, but this is implicit in what he said. So how do we do it? We're rooted in this self-clinging, and yet it's that self-clinging that has to get out of the way. It's even, as it were, from the point of view of self-clinging that we can identify that self-clinging. You know, I'm really delighted by my own clever thinking in expounding this. In other words, there's some, you know, investment of ego clinging in it, inevitably. It's all right, I know you're all the same, so I'm not going to look embarrassed. So... How do we begin to get it out of the way? Well, what we have to do is use it in order to get it out of the way. We identify with it and we use its momentum to carry us beyond it. In other words, well, we use the force of karma. I'll have a little bit more to say about that in a moment, but I wanted to just address something that's really comes prior to that. That the order has been founded on the basis of effective going for refuge, of a community of men and women who go for refuge to the Three Jewels effectively. What that means, I believe, is that we identify our self, our self-interest, our self-identity, we identify it with that current that moves through us from beyond us. So when we take on ordination, we're even given a new name. And that is our espousal of an identity that is bound up with, that is based upon that force moving through us. Force, I use advisedly. That force moving through us, that goal drawing us on. That's what our identity is effectively based upon at the moment of ordination. One thing that's quite interesting that I think requires further investigation, or maybe it's new for me, maybe others have thought about it, but there's also a question of disidentification. One does need to identify with those forces moving through one that are the forces of going for refuge, but one also traditionally de-identifies with those forces that oppose that movement. It's quite tricky, this area, because, of course, there's plenty of space for psychological distortion. So I'm assuming a bunch of healthy men and women, which I think is a fair one here. In other words, that we're not confused about who we are. We're not tied up with superegos and split personalities and so forth. We're reasonably healthy and integrated. Yeah? Don't give two answers. That would be confusing. So do you see what I mean? A word of caution on the bottle, on the label. But it's not just a question of identifying ourselves with the force of going for refuge. It's a question of de-identifying from the forces of going for refuge the other way, to the world, if you like, going for refuge to a false identities and so on. I've been led to think about this because recently I did some study with the wives of the men's ordination team. I have to school myself not to say my wives, but over the last couple of years, I've had the great delight of working with the wives of my close colleagues in the men's ordination team, which has been an unexpected delight, as I say. They do an enormous amount for the ordination team. They carry a lot of weight. And I felt I should, sort of acknowledge that. But in doing so, I realised with these are women who are really serious about a Dhamma life. And some of them are order members, many are not. But because their husbands are so closely involved with the ordination process, they're kind of drawn to that world and to understanding it. And it's been extremely interesting to me. I mean, particularly, they're all mothers. So sort of dealing with, what the Dhamma life means has brought up, issues of attachment and their fears and insecurities. And in India, insecurities are deep, deep. Which I found very, very touching, their honesty and their willingness to look very closely at these things. But anyway, I just wanted to say that because I'm delighted by it. But this time I chose 10 suttas from Samyutta Nikaya, from the Bhikkhuni Samyutta, And I strongly recommend it, perhaps particularly to Dhammacharanis, but to all. It's 10. It's an account of short accounts of 10 bhikkhunis, all of whom it turns out are arahats, who each on their own go into the jungle near Saranath, not Shravasti. I got it the wrong way around yesterday, sorry. I always get them mixed up. So they go into the jungle one by one. I mean, you know, it's separate occasions, presumably. And when they get to the foot of a tree and sit down and fold their legs ready for meditation, Mara comes. And Mara, the beast, knows them inside out. And he goes for each one's weak spot, which is what Mara does, because he knows you better than you know yourself, because that's where he lives. So, for instance, Kisagotami, you know, the one who carried around the dead baby, she's by now an arahat, and Mara comes to her and says, "Oh, look at you, all poor, poor girl, all on your own. Don't you want another son? Are you here looking for a man?" And Kisagotami just says, "I know who you are. You're Mara. And, you know, why would I want sons? Why would I want a man? I need nothing. I've got everything." And each of them speaks in this way. And it's very, very interesting, partly because of the nature of the attack that Mara gives to each. To one, for instance, he says, "What are you sitting there doing sitting there? You're a woman. What can you possibly achieve sitting there?" So she says to him, "You know, when you're concentrated, you're not either a man or a woman. And if you think, I am a man, I am a woman, I am anything, then you're in Mara's realm." Hmm. Very interesting. But what I wanted to draw attention to was the confrontation with Mara. And, you know, they were asking, who is Mara, you know, where does he live, so to speak? What's his address? And I started to give a more conventional kind of understanding that I think I've kind of used myself in the past. Oh, he's a personification of, you know, the forces of, you know, retrograde forces in your mind. But I suddenly realized that this was more than just a personification. It was a conscious identification of feelings and thoughts arising within you as not you. It's not alienation, because that's an unconscious process, but it's a deliberate decision that these forces are not mine. I'm not going to let them drive me. Bhante's talked about this many times in the past. I've never really taken it in. And after reading this, I just found I could deal with quite a number of old patterns just by saying that's Mara. Then you know how to deal with them. So I think that it's important to recognize that conscious identification with going for refuge also has its corollary, conscious de-identification with what does not go for refuge. Of course, if you perform the actions that don't go for refuge, I mean, go in the opposite direction, not just neutral, well, then you have identified with them. But when the thoughts and the feelings arise, you don't allow them to become part of your identity. So I find that quite interesting, and maybe it requires further thought. But when you think that the whole issue of identity is an issue of construction, we construct our identity. We construct it in quite superficial ways, in terms of I'm good at this, I'm good at that, I'm this sort of person, I'm that sort of person. We construct it in terms of I'm English, I'm this, I'm that, I'm man, I'm woman. I mean, it's something more than just biology. We construct it in so many ways. And of course, we construct it very, very deeply in terms of this self that stands apart from experience, owning it. So it's all constructed. It's samya. It's It's an artificial process that's added on to the raw data of experience. It's interpretation. So why shouldn't we identify or de-identify and re-identify aspects of our experience, so long as we're doing it in a healthy context, on a healthy basis, not out of self-hatred or as a way of not taking responsibility or something like that. I hope I've communicated myself there. But yes, we start by identifying ourselves with those forces that spontaneously unfold from within us and that move towards something appearing without us, to put it that way. But then we have to, having identified with that force, we have to use that identification to work with karma. Because karma shapes the way in which our mind unfolds. This, I think, is a very important understanding. I'm sure I'm not the only person to have it, but it's a very, very important understanding that the mind that we have now is at the level of moral identity is formed from the mind that we had in the future, from in the past, the actions that we performed in the past. Of course, a lot of what we experience is to do with neurology and so forth. You know, I've not been able to think very clearly the last few days. That's because I've got a head cold and jet lagged and all that. But, when you age, the whole mechanism isn't going to work as well. Your basic sense of fulfillment, integrity, and so forth, it's not really your happiness and unhappiness, because that can too easily be understood in merely pleasure and pain terms. But your fulfillment or your lack of fulfillment, they're dictated by karma, by your skillful or unskillful actions. They form for you a mind that is more fulfilled, more in tune, more in harmony, more open, more sensitive, feeling more open to what really is, and so on. So we work with karma on the basis of our false sense self-identification, which we've then begun to shift by identifying it with going for refuge. And as we work with it, so our mind unfolds in a way that is more plastic, more elastic, more sensitive, more clear, less prejudiced, and more open. That naturally unfolds as we perform skillful action. And the way we do this is, of course, principally through those two aspects of the Dhamma life that are the basis of Bhante's system. Integration and positive emotion or skillful intention. Integration means the acceptance and recognition of our moral identity, of our karmic responsibility. That's what integration fundamentally means. It means taking possession of our karmic responsibility. Not blaming others, not accusing situations or people, not finding excuses, not blinding ourselves, and so on. But accepting our responsibility for our actions. Even though in a certain sense, it's illusory. I've just been reading a neurological account of selfhood, and it quotes that factoid that is now fairly familiar and probably be discredited in a few weeks' time, but that we form an intention to move our arms in the brain, electrically in the brain, before we form a conscious intention to move. So that apparently by up to 7 seconds, movements are, decisions to do something are prefigured by, you know, small chemical and electrical changes in the brain and the nerves. So it's an illusion. We have an illusion of control, but we use that illusion. That's basically what karma is. Karma is the kind of conditionality that arises when you believe you're an I, if you see what I mean. If you identify yourself as a centre of experience and an agent of action, then you enter into a relationship with the world around you and with your own future experience that is reciprocal. A skillful action leads to an unfoldment in a fulfilling direction, put it blandly like that. An unskillful action leads to stultification, closing off, and so forth, broadly speaking, with all sorts of complexities. So integration means the full acceptance of one's karmic responsibility. Yes, we do practices like mindfulness of breathing and so forth, mindfulness practices generally, which help us to take that responsibility, become fully possessed of our own karmic responsibility. And this is the very basis of Dhamma life. Without it, no progress, because you're constantly undermining what small efforts you make by unskillful action or careless action or whatever. And of course, once you've taken possession of your karmic responsibility, you consciously try to form it, form your intentions in a skillful direction. You form intentions based on maitri, on generosity, on awareness, and so on. You deliberately, you consciously try to bring about within you skillful intentions. So this is mainly to do with karma. You can interpret both these in other terms too, but fundamentally that's what they're about. They're about working with the forces of karma that arise from the fact that we identify ourselves instinctively as an independent author of our actions. So the business of discipline through integration and skillful intention is all to do with getting out of the way of that fundamental drive, that fundamental flow that is going for refuge, or that fundamental pull, whichever way you like to look at it, because pulls and pushes are the same in the end. Of course, you also need to be working to open yourself up more to that inner flow. And this is at least one understanding that I have of dhammic receptivity. But what you're doing in dhammic receptivity, spiritual receptivity, I'm trying to get rid of spiritual. But the dhammic receptivity, to me, implies opening yourself up so that you experience your deepest motivations beyond I, or the deepest motivations that come from beyond I. It's the sort of thing you often experience on solitary. Well, I say you, I often experience on solitary retreat. You go on solitary retreat with this very, I go on solitary retreat with this very high intention. I'm going to meditate all day, 48 hours a day. I'm going to read the Dhamma. I've got all these books. I'm going to work right way through it. And it lasts for about the first morning. And then, after a little while, I realize I don't want to do any of it. In fact, I have no idea what I want to do. I did a 5-month solitary, 8 months isolated, 5 months completely solitary. And it's a really disturbing experience because it's going on for a long time. It's not over in a week or 2 weeks or a month. And I just don't know what to do. I couldn't even work out how to get out of bed. Now, I know that everybody has those moments, but this is sort of more like, I just wanted to know how you get out of bed. you know, I know it's one leg and the other leg, but what pushes you out of bed is really interesting. Of course, eventually you find yourself in the toilet having a pee because nature has taken over. You don't want to... Anyway. But just trying to see why you do things, why you make movement in certain direction and not another. What's the point of this? What's the point of that? I found it quite disturbing, even quite painful, for quite a long time. Just being becalmed. I suppose, good extrovert that I am in part, I'm quite strongly drawn to the outer world. And it had gone. It was just full of sheep. And frankly, they don't incite much action. You know, why do anything? What to do? You sit, you make yourself sit, because nothing else you can do, and you exhaust all the other possibilities of distracting yourself, because they just don't work. And eventually, one feels something sort of trickling up from, you know, you use a metaphor like a deeper dimension or something like that, something coming from somewhere else that you weren't expecting. Not necessarily that it invites you or incites you to do anything, but that just sort of makes everything complete and makes, in a way, action unnecessary, because everything is there. There's nothing to do. Everything is sort of fulfilled within you, to put it that way. But it's not just within you, because that would imply a sort of solipsism, but outside you too. Everything is as it should be, put it that way. Lots and lots of put it that ways in this talk. This dhammic receptivity, to me, is trying to suspend your restless willing and suspend it very, very deeply. Remember, restlessness is it the ninth samyojana? I never get that far. Still working on the first. But yes, it's among the last samyojanas. It's a very, very, what Bhante describes, the last tremor of restlessness, he says, before you let go completely. So, yeah, just sort of letting go, letting go, letting go, and stopping yourself. Well, I thought of it as being trying to be reborn. The Book of the Dead has always been a strong metaphor for me. And in the Book of the Dead, in the Bardo, you remember, you have an almost desperate longing for a body. You want an identity. You want to be somebody somewhere. Overwhelming desire, which eventually drives you into a womb. And I felt that drive very, very strongly, thinking about what was going to happen when I came out. 5 months away, I'm going to do this. Wait a minute. It's 5 long months to wait. I know what. I'll write a book. I actually started. I think I started 3 books. You know, that's just seeking a rebirth, seeking an identity, seeking to be somebody. And, could be good. Probably could have been good books, but not what I'm there for. Just wait. Don't let yourself be reborn. Well, I thought of the verses from the root verses. Recall the revulsion and think of resistance. You know, the revulsion that comes as you actually do get re-entangled. Because, of course, your relief from that freedom is also a sense of re-imprisonment. They're coextensive. So I think dhammic receptivity is this sort of radical refusal to be reborn. Is the radical acceptance of Bardo, the radical opening of yourself and to see what is there. Bhante used to always extol the virtues of boredom, saying how valuable boredom is. Never been much bored myself. I've had to learn to get bored. But boredom is a sense of not being engaged, not really connecting with what's going on around you. And Bhante says it's a really valuable state because it's a sort of a tunnel down to real engagement. So if you sit with boredom, don't try to distract yourself. Don't try to run away. But just sit with that boredom. Sooner or later, and this is certainly my experience, something begins to percolate up from deeper down. So I think the third of the five aspects that you've been practicing in these days is to do with opening yourself up to the that force moving through you from beyond you, to put it that way. You're deliberately suspending your willing. The willing suspension of willing. You're refusing to allow yourself to get caught up. You watch your mind just going through all the cycles. I'll do this, I'll do that. They did this, they did that. I'll say this, I'll say that. And you just let them go. Just let them go. And you allow something to open up. However you do it, whatever approach you have to it, that needs to be an aspect of our Dhamma life. I think what otherwise happens is that you're all focused on the karmic effort. It's all about karma. It's all about exercising responsibility, making an effort. And that is a very large part of it. But unfortunately, if that effort is not placed in a larger context, it can become self-defeating. I've certainly noticed this with myself and other people, that you can become so sort of proud of your own discipline. You can become so caught up in your own ability to act skillfully, and you forget what it's all about. You forget why you're doing it. I mean, it's worth doing in itself. To be skillful is a good thing for other people, at the very least. But you're doing it so that you can get out of the way, so that you can lessen self-attachment, so that that transcendental subject, that something coming through you, can manifest more and more fully. The erotic force that Padmavajra and I will be talking about. Get your money in the slot now. Of course, that's not enough. It's important to keep in contact with that force, to experience it as the background to everything that you do. But you also need to more directly attack the structure, the construction of self-clinging, and to see its constructed nature, to recognize that it is ultimately artificial, and that there is, as it were, something that is not constructed, not artificial, that is naturally available to you. Of course, we have many ways of doing that. We have many practices of spiritual death, to use Bhante's category, many practices of vipassana, or prajna, whatever you like to call it, and many different ways of going about it. And I think that there could arguably be as many ways of going about it as there are individual people. We've got practices, but in the end, it's not a practice, it's something quite direct. Talking to Bhante the other day, he was just commenting on some of the discussion going on in Shabda more recently about these topics, and he had three things to say. So first of all, he thought that it was important that people recognized that insight arose in a range of ways. And he thought there was something of a tendency to insight fundamentalism. He didn't use that term, but putting it my way, that people tend to fix on a particular approach and become you know, ardent proselytizers of it and convinced that it's the way. But people are different, approaches are different, times are different, circumstances are different. And we need to honour that, the huge variety of human type and kind and the many different possible ways of approaching. But it's something I think we need to have some wider discussion about, what an approach to spiritual death is and how we can make sure that we share a common vocabulary of it. It's something that I know is being thought of as a point of investigation by the college and others. Banta made a second point, was that he thought people needed to recognise that there were degrees of insight. And it really, in a way, didn't matter what degree of insight there was, but there are degrees. And yes, probably most people have had some degree of insight, otherwise not sure what we're doing here. But not to get too hung up on it and not to get too fixed on the idea that one has got it. There's another point there, gone from me. Anyway, I'll come back to it. Yes, that we need to recognise that insight has degrees that then the third point is that there's more to do. There's more to do. Whatever the degree, you've got further to go. You've not arrived until, in the traditional exposition, until arahatva, until ashrava kshaya jnana, the knowledge of the destruction of the ashravas, you haven't arrived. And who knows whether you have then either. But you've got more effort to make, more work to do. It'll happen, but you can make it happen more quickly. So he thought that people should just sort of calm down. Well, this is my... He didn't say that. But it's important just to sort of realise, well, the different ways it happens, different ways for different people. There's degrees of insight. And, there's always more to do. And that's probably enough said. I think there's something else that could be said, though. Banta didn't say it, I stress, although I'm sure he would have done if he'd felt like it. You need to always remember the full spread. You need to remember all five aspects. Otherwise, I think there's a strong tendency to over-identify with one or other aspect. You over-identify, well, few people over-identify with integration or positive emotion, but you can over-identify with the others, and particularly with some experience of spiritual death. And actually, you've still got a lot of work to do just at integration and positive emotion and opening yourself up, receptivity, and indeed rebirth. So, yes, with rebirth as a practice, you're deliberately trying to connect with what transcends that framework of self-clinging. You're deliberately trying to connect with the transcendental object, to put it that way. You could say in a way that in the in dhammic receptivity, you're trying to connect with the transcendental subject. This is my own little parsing. But in spiritual rebirth, you're trying to connect with the transcendental object. Of course, the distinction breaks down once you begin to look at it at all closely. But you're deliberately setting up in front of you a representation, an image of what goes beyond self-clinging. And you're deliberately trying to evoke it. And in the course of doing that, you enable yourself to lessen self-clinging more and more. And if it's accompanied by work in all the other areas, eventually to be reborn. What does that mean? Well, I've read the books. I assure you I'm saying no more than that. The first thing, of course, is that what happens is a sequence of conditioned arisings take place. One state gives rise to another state, gives rise to another state, but without the intervention of I, without the intervention of a conscious intention or volition. They unfold spontaneously, naturally, one from the other. What you may experience when this happens is, of course, a sequence of states. We're told in the positive nidanas, you experience nibbida or nirveda, disgust, a rejection of everything that previously had held you, a sort of a very positive and healthy kind of pushing away of everything that had encased you before. That leads to viraga, vairagya, which means dispassion, which means a very, very positive state of disentanglement, non-reactivity, perhaps even upeksha, where nothing actually pulls on you. You're just completely free of it all. And that leads to vimukti, that leads to ashrava kshayanyana, and so on. So a sequence of steps and stages, of inner steps and stages that you find unfolding within you, naturally and spontaneously, upon yathabhuta jnana darshan, darshana, knowledge and vision of things as they really are. But it's not how you may actually experience it. That's the sort of safest way of describing it, a sequence of conditioned arisings. But well, Bhante describes something of his own experience in this respect in terms of this suprapersonal force that he experienced as working through him. Now, we mustn't take this literally. There isn't a suprapersonal force. It doesn't exist. It's not up there, down there, or over there. It's a manner of speaking. It's a metaphor. It's the way Bhante's talking about how it seemed to him. The best way he could explain to himself how he felt. It was as if something was motivating him, which wasn't him. At the same time, it wasn't sort of him being taken over through schizoid alienation or something like that. Something which he willingly participated, cooperated with, which he's very happy to move with, but that wasn't his volition. A force or a volition moving through him that wasn't his volition, you could say, an energy, a motivation. We need to be very careful with this language. I was aware in using this in that paper that it was a huge hostage to fortune, but it seemed in a way you can't avoid moving into poetry occasionally. Please, you agree, Macho Bandhu? Yeah. We need to be able to use metaphor and symbol and image and so forth. Another way we may experience is it in terms of even other beings. Bhante speaks of the so-called archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas as arising within the Dhamma Niyama process. So you could describe those Dhamma Niyama processes in terms of Nibbida and Viraga, or you can describe them in terms of the Avalokiteshvara Jnana Sattva. That might be your way of experiencing it. You could experience it in terms of a strong motivation to help. Not a sentimental motivation. It's not compassion in the sense that we usually mean it. It's, in a sense, impersonal. It's not anything to do with feeling in the ordinary sense. It's a response, a natural, immediate response of an awakened mind, a mind that is not obstructed by self-clinging to the world around. I used an illustration in that paper that I rather liked. You know, you see somebody drop a £5 note in front of you. Well, I don't know about you, but I generally lean down, pick it up and give it to him. And, you know, they might say, oh, thank you so much. That's so good of you. They didn't even think about it. Your arm reaches out to pick it up without you having sort of almost consciously decided it. Well, that's an analogy. I'm not saying that's the Dhamma Niyama processes or anything like that, but it's an analogy. So I imagine that's the sort of experience you get. That's what Bhante's describing, this impersonal force or a suprapersonal force, that it just happens. This is Amoghasiddhi's, I can't remember the jnana now, infallible success of, what is it? Action accomplishing, thank you. All accomplishing, whatever. Abhante describes that a sort of mysterious motivation that is completely inexplicable. Something happens, that the Buddha, the Bodhisattva does something, and you can't altogether explain it because it comes from something beyond our normal mode of understanding motivation. So there's all these different ways in which one might experience this force moving through one. Time is marching, so I'm going to have to draw to a close. But I hope what I've done is to sort of locate all of these five aspects within the context of karma and dharma, and within the context especially of this strong inner drive that I sense so much in Bhante, and that Bhante has, I believe, affirmed so strongly in me, and no doubt in everybody here, and that is really the fundamental basis for our order and movement, that we do have that inner direction, that we are motivated from within towards the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. It's not something imposed by the will, not imposed by the intellect, although intellect and will have to cooperate with it in activating karma. But that is the spirit that I think is absolutely fundamental to the future of our order and movement. A sense that we're constantly bringing things back to something real emerging within people. It's that we're responding to when people come through our doors, the doors of our centres, and that we're trying to encourage them to activate. And we've got our panoply of practices and teachings and so forth for that purpose, not to impose upon them or to restrict them, but to enable them to unfold something that is natural to them, even though there's so much about them that is resisting, at least in the early stages, which means for several lifetimes. So I hope that sort of rounded out the complete picture of what I've been talking about over the last days. I haven't altogether had a clear idea of where I was going. I don't think, because I'm so inspired, that there's an unconscious, a supraconscious motivation. I think just because I had a head cold. But I hope that does present a sort of a rounded picture of even why I think these lineages are important. Bhante's Adhisthana works through those lineages. Bhante's Adhisthana, what it did to me, what Bhante's spiritual power or force, to use that term, did to me, and I'm sure to many of you, all of you, was to affirm that deep, deep drive within me, that deep instinct within me. He gave it an answer. He responded to it. Something in him responded to something in me, or maybe without him even knowing it. Something in me responded to that Adhisthana in him. And it's that we must keep alive, brothers and sisters, that our structures, our responsibilities as chairmen, secretaries, treasurers, or whatever we are about. Is that our teaching is about. It's that our practices are about. It's keeping alive that that natural unfolding that every human being is capable of. Thank you.